Welcome to the next episode about business models. So we will continue our exploration of various business models and how they relate to open source licensing and open source community and so on. So let's dive straight into it.
Great.
The next model is physical products, which I think is kind of interesting. So instead of paying for software or even being aware that you pay for software, you pay for a physical product containing open source to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
Android is there. It's super common in that perspective.
Exactly. So basically everybody has it in their pocket right now.
Yeah, I mean, there must be more products with open source in them than without, I would say, absolutely, today if you look at gizmos.
Yes, exactly. Especially now that Linux is so big inside of embedded devices, you have Linux basically almost everywhere.
Yeah. And it's always kind of cool when you get this thick paper book with the GNU licenses when you buy some cheap gizmo in some store.
Exactly.
But I mean, what fascinates me is that you can actually add value to a product by doing this. Mm-hmm. So to me, it's nice when the product is hacker friendly, where I can actually change the firmware, where it's open, where the firmware comes from.
Exactly.
So I mean, it allows me to extend the life of the product or adapt it to my use cases.
And the funny thing is, once they release, for example, the firmware, other people will contribute. So I'm thinking about a specific thing, which is the Conbi stick, which is a USB stick, which you can buy for, I think, 20 or 30 euros. And it connects to your Zigbee devices. So which then can, you can communicate switching on and off Philips Hue lamps and stuff like that. And this Conbi stick has free firmware. So you can just go on GitHub and download it, build it yourself, change it, whatever you want, and contribute back. And because people are contributing back, new people are buying more of those Conbi sticks because new devices are supported, which you can connect to. So it's gotten quite big in this community, this Conbi stick, and they have a second version and a lot of people are buying those just because it's so open, so that more and more you as a user get more and more from it because it has this open firmware.
I mean, there are lots of these like hacker-friendly products, like the Conbi stick, as you say. You know, I mean, technically, I think you can classify the Arduinos and the Raspberry Pis and so on there, and the Pine 64s and all of that.
Yeah.
And then there are all the consumer goods where you don't really see that it's software. Something that fascinates me is the ones that come in the middle. So I'm thinking about routers, for instance. What's the name of this firmware?
WRT.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, last time I got a router, it was actually pre-installed with a Netgear derived firmware that was WRTE, and they provide instructions for how to sort of, you can upload your own firmware. Everything supports it out of the box.
Exactly.
So it's something my mom could buy because it's a router, but it's something that adds more value to me because they choose to make it open.
Exactly. That was also a reason why I bought a Linksys router, because of the fact that you can just flash it with open source software if you don't like their software. Absolutely. But yeah, as you say, my dad would also be just buy the same thing, but just use the pre-installed stuff.
Exactly. And then you can get, I mean, that's this whole extending the life of a product. Then you can connect 4G modems and stuff to it that perhaps the USB stick was only meant for file sharing from the beginning and so on. So there, to me, that really adds value. And it also has to do with this, the greener aspect. Then why do we have to throw electronics away? If we can repurpose it, it actually makes a lot of sense.
So obviously, if you sell devices, you want to sell more. But sometimes making it green, making it possible to hack, making it possible to extend the life makes people buy next time when they need one, your device and not something proprietary.
Exactly. And I mean, this is quite interesting. We talked about Qt earlier on. And I mean, Nokia acquired Trolltech, which was then a software company, and shifted it over to sort of a handset business where they wanted to maximize the utilization of the software. So they made Qt even more open, just to attract more Qt developers and build the talent pool, because their income stream was the physical handsets.
Exactly.
So, I mean, it's both you and I work in an industry where some of the open source licenses are questioned. I mean, it's DPLV3, for instance, the reasoning seems to be sort of liability and regulatory things to be able to sell, in this case, cars. I guess it could probably apply to medical equipment as well. But at the same time, they let someone like me change brake pads, which I would be more worried about. But, I mean, I hope to see a change here sometime to actually make devices more hackable. And I mean, you have the whole right to repair movement, all of that.
So I think it's, as you say, it's a back and forth between the users and the companies and the lawyers and so on and so on.
Definitely. And I mean, I had a hard time coming up with consumer examples, but we have, I mean, everything from a hacker device like the Raspberry Pi and really limited devices or limited. My mom wouldn't buy a Pine 64 in that way, limited,
no.
But very open. But we have if you look at the Android, which to me is an open core thing, but it contains open source. It's definitely made possible because of open source. Yeah. And also routers, Conbees.
Yeah. Also, I'm thinking about all those boxes which you buy for having like a bunch of services at home, where sometimes there's a Raspberry Pi in pre-installed software which you just buy as a package. Sometimes it's a specific hardware and you buy it, and then you have a web server possibility to host a lot of things, everything pre-installed, and so on, and just buy the hardware. And there are a lot of those devices, actually, even if they are always, they start as small and not many people buy them yet, because it's much easier just to go to Google and get a Gmail address instead of hosting your own email server at home from a smaller company and so on. But I think it will, people are getting better at understanding all the privacy concerns, and this will be bigger in the future, I think.
Yeah, and I think there will be regulations, because you have the Nest story, where you basically brick the hardware devices by disabling the cloud side. Right to repair, where I mean, there are very strong laws preventing this, especially in the US. And I mean, it's a counter movement. And combining that with the whole like green and movement with climate emergency and so on, it makes a lot of sense.
Absolutely.
To regulate in this direction. And I don't think what it does prevent is overcharging. Why would you subscribe to a physical product? Then
Exactly.
But buy hackable things. It's fun and good for the environment. Hopefully.
And it helps those companies which do offer those things, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then, I mean, then these might be more expensive, but it's also because they are useful for a longer period and might have a higher quality because of that, and or more expensive components.
Often when I'm thinking about those Google Home, those small speakers, they are so cheap because Google wants to have a device connected to their server at home in your bedroom, basically. So the hardware would be much more expensive. So you're paying less with money, but you are paying a lot of with privacy, which is also quite concerning to a lot of people.
Definitely. So another quite popular model seems to be the open core, where you have an open source project that is publicly available. You can do like early adopters and the self-hosting crowd that wants to run this on their own infrastructure and hobbyists can get into it. But you also add extensions, proprietary extensions to that. And that's really where the money stream comes from. I mean, in theory, you can get code contributors back from the community, but I'm not sure how much of that actually takes place.
I think it does happen. I'm looking at GitLab, for example. I'm not sure if you have it as an example, GitLab has the has exactly this, where they have open core, so you get the whole thing. You can install it and so on. And they have their own GitLab instance for issues, and you can contribute back. And it does happen. Obviously, they are still the main contributor. But people want sometimes some small feature, so they implement it and get it back into their core, basically.
And I mean, this has to do then with the trust between the community and the company owning the product. So I mean, if you feel that you get a large portion of the product, then you might be able to or willing to spend your time. But if there is no trust, then I guess the contributions won't come either.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, especially it's really dependent on the project. Exactly what you say. If I feel that I get anyway most of the stuff when I contribute, then I feel that I'm as a developer getting things for my value, for my time, basically. But if they just take it and most of the stuff is anyway closed source, then it's not that attractive for me to contribute.
Yeah. I mean, some comments from a licensing perspective then is that this usually leads to quite complex licenses. So the provider needs to be able to mix in proprietary or closed source addition to the open source project. There might be contributions license agreements to make sure that they have copyright to allow them to do this, or the open source licenses themselves might be might look a bit odd, so to speak.
It should work well with like really permissive licenses like MIT and BSD.
That would work well. And I mean, if you use some weak copyleft, I think it would work as well. Even with strong copyright, if you make sure that the hooks are so that you don't do linking or derivative work, so to speak, but rather provide like REST interfaces and web hooks and stuff, you can still build these things.
Yes.
You might even be able to sort of cooperate around a database, I guess. If you want like integration with the user database, you can have another tool that pokes into the database that the open source project uses.
Yeah. There are always ways of IPCs and so on.
Yeah, but you still need to be a bit careful there, and it might reflect on the licensing or the architecture of the setup.
Depending. Yeah, especially the architecture, yes. Absolutely.
Yeah. And this again is one of those things that I think combines quite well with services. I mean, even for the open source part, the supplier or even someone else can sort of sell installation services and those things in addition to these commercial add-ons.
Yes.
So when it comes to examples, you mentioned GitLab. I mentioned Qt to some extent. That there has been add-ons given there. I'm not sure if we have other good examples.
Yeah, we have Confluence and Jira, for example, from Atlassian.
Do they have an open source base?
They used to, I think, at least.
Could be. I'm not sure.
I mean, you can self-host these tools.
Yeah, but that's not open source.
It's no, just that's true, but it generally works easier if it is open source. Okay, I will not. I'm not 100%, but that was my understanding before, at least.
I think it's Atlassian. I don't think it's Confluence or Jira, but I think Atlassian has. What was it? One of the other tools. Which they host code and so on.
Bitbucket.
So early versions of Bitbucket were written in Python, and there were, perhaps it's still, but they were quite like open core, and then you could add stuff to it. I'm also not 100% sure, but I know that there was something from Atlassian which was open source.
Yeah, apparently Jira is not open source.
I do know that at least Confluence is written in Java from the error messages you get from the
yes, pages. Yes. I think it's Bitbucket, which was open source, or still is. I don't remember. What more? Open core. Yeah, I guess it's mostly like bigger things which you run. But I can't come up with something good either.
I mean, commonly it's like, if you look at GitLab, you get like LDAP integrations and stuff. So for sort of enterprise grade integrations,
yeah,
these kind of things that aren't really useful for home user or a small open source project.
Yeah.
And when you have a big enterprise user, they probably want to pay for it anyway because they want the service agreements and all of that around it. So it's a way to fund the open source part of it.
But I think I might be wrong, but I get the feeling at least that it's not something the open source community is very so the purists are not very fond of because they feel that it muds. Muddy so water, so you still can say yeah our stuff is open source, but really only like really small parts are open source. So you market it as open source, but only small parts are open source.
If you want it to be useful, you'll need the enterprise version anyway.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, this links back to the contribution part. I mean, if you provide enough as open source, you might actually be able to get the benefits of being an open source project. So you get community maintenance, community fixes, and these things. If it's just a marketing gimmick, basically, then the community won't exist in that way, at least.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And that concludes the second episode about business models. You can, as always, reach us at foss-north.se/pod. Or follow us on YouTube and ConfTube. Enjoy. Bye-bye.